Magical Realism, featuring a very special dog.
He has formed his pack, unbeknownst really to the humans, and he's the kind of dog who would throw himself in front of a train if he thought it would save his pack.
And then more magical realism with a woman of a certain age.
There are many ways in which Clover has become invisible to her family before she actually becomes invisible physiologically.
That's Jean Ray. Later, we'll talk with her about her novel, Calling Invisible Women. Before that, we heard a clip from our first interview today with novelist Jacqueline Sheehan about her latest work of fiction, Picture This. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Jacqueline Sheehan's first breakout bestseller was the mystery novel Lost and Found. It featured a newly widowed psychologist named Rocky, who quits her job and moves to an island off the coast of Maine. There she finds a wounded black lab, Cooper, who heals her psychic wounds as she heals his physical ones. Now Rocky and Cooper are back with Sheehan's new book. It's called Picture This. This time, the wounded soul is a troubled young woman, claiming a family connection to Rocky's late husband. Rocky embraces her as a link to her past and a chance to redeem the future. But all is not as it seems, and Cooper, the dog, shows he has better instincts than some of the humans in the story. Jacqueline Sheehan is a former psychologist and the author of two other novels as well, Now and Then and A Comet's Tale. Well, Jacqueline Sheehan, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca.
This thoroughly entertaining and enlightening book, Picture This, this is the sequel to your last novel, Lost and Found. Tell us about the main character for those of our listeners who didn't hear our last interview about Lost and Found. Tell us about the protagonist, Rocky Pellegrino.
First, I want to say that this is my fourth novel, and this Picture This is the sequel to Lost and Found, which was my second book. So there was a book in between there, very different. But anyhow, just a point of clarification. Rocky is a psychologist, as am I, but I made great efforts to separate Rocky from me. She's a younger woman whose husband died quite suddenly in the first book, and she is was really left without any mooring whatsoever, left her job, and went to Peaks Island off of Portland, Maine, where she connected with a community of people who presented her with options for growth. And a dog who presented her with options for quite a bit of growth. And by that, I mean, one of the things that happened to Rocky in the first book was that she could not find herself and really struggled with the guilt of not being able to save her husband. When she took a job as an animal control officer, and she found a black lab who'd been injured, and she was able to save this dog, and he became a larger and larger part of her life, really eventually saving her. I think the two of them saved each other.
I guess they did save each other, although I have to say I think that the dog did a more profound job of saving. This dog is Cooper. He is an amazing dog. You write him a bit, especially in the first book, but somewhat in the second, almost shading over into magical realism or the supernatural.
Yeah, thank you for noticing that. Yeah, I think if you go into the point of view of a dog, if you go into the point of view of a house, if you've got, animals, communicating with other people on this level, we've really entered the realm of magical realism. And people love to hear the point of view of Cooper. I can't tell you how many emails I get from readers who are convinced that if they could hear their dog talk, they would talk like Cooper. or they would think like Cooper. We only hear him thinking.
So talk a little bit about this process of writing this character of the dog, Cooper.
He's pretty much of a sage. He is wiser and more multi-sensory than almost all of the characters in the book.
And he sees the other characters as being in his pack, and he's the alpha dog. Is that right?
He is, although I don't even know if I really believe in the alpha dog theory anymore. He has formed his pack, unbeknownst really to the humans. I don't think they're as consciously aware of it as he is. And he's the kind of dog who would throw himself in front of a train if he thought it would save his pack.
He's not quite as prominent a character in this book, Picture This, than he was in the first one. Was that a conscious decision? Was that something you decided, even though he is one of the major characters, you don't get into his interior dialogue as much as you do in the first one?
No, in the first one, the story was really more about Rocky and Cooper. In this book, there are new characters, for example, Natalie. And Natalie is on a mission. You know, Natalie has a trajectory. She's a young 18-year-old girl who's been deeply hurt and appears at Rocky's door. And she's a complicated young person who is making choices that are not immediately apparent.
She's making choices that are not immediately apparent. You're being very cryptic there. And this is a kind of a mystery, too. So we have to be cryptic to a certain degree.
She appears at Rocky's door saying, "I believe that I am the biological child of your husband," and appears to not know that the husband had died. She's been in foster care for the majority of her life. And this really triggers something very profound with Rocky, who seems to put aside some of her other sensibilities in order to help this young woman.
Maybe out of a little bit of survivor's guilt?
Well, yeah, exactly that. Rocky really had a wonderful marriage with a terrific guy, cut short, but they really had a very, very good life together. And here is this, you know, young 18-year-old girl who begins to share very piecemeal that her life was anything but terrific. And other people on the island have senses that Rocky seems to have momentarily abandoned. her young friend, Melissa, who's in high school, who in the first book struggled very much with anorexia, and who in this book is beginning to grow up, and she's not so self-obsessed anymore, and she is really beginning to see things, partly through the help of learning photography at her high school, but she is really seeing things perhaps in a better way than Rocky is.
Well, a little more clear-eyed. Let's go back, though, to Natalie, the young woman who contacts Rocky. She has a horrific history, as you have referred to, a history that very much involves the foster care system, abandonment by her mother, sexual abuse, and you could almost say that she's somebody who's really suffering from an attachment disorder. I mean, could you say that she's suffering from an attachment disorder?
Oh, as a psychologist looking at this particular person's history, that's exactly what I would call it.
And could you,
at the very least.
So tell us what that's about. I mean, just like your first book went into, you know, issues around grief and mourning and then anorexia, this book does really explore the psychological issues around attachment disorders. Tell us what that is and what is the impact that it tends to have on people's lives lifelong.
Attachment disorder can begin in several ways. One of the more well-known ways is with a baby who has severe colic, and the caretakers and the baby are unable to form a bond that is mutually satisfying in any way because the caretaker has a screaming baby who they cannot soothe, and the baby is constantly agitated and in pain, abdominal pain. So there is one genesis for attachment disorder, that there is just not that very primary animal kind of bond that can lead to very destroyed relationships later on when people try to attach and they simply don't have the tools. In Natalie's case, without giving away too much, she grew up with a mother who quickly became addicted to crack cocaine, and she did not have those beginning skills. We don't know about her as a baby. We don't know lots of details about that, but we do learn about her from about age two or three on, that no adults were safe in her environment, and that somehow this child was going to have to take care of herself at an absurdly young age.
You know, the foster care system, she's brought into it. It at first appears to be, you know, a pretty horrific system, very much like the ideas of the foster care system that we have, that it's, you know, just kind of a hellhole of abuse. Jacqueline Sheehan, in this newest novel, Picture This, what kinds of things were you trying to say about the foster care system, and what's been your experience of it as a psychologist?
Well, reading through the entire book, you'll find that I'm saying many things about the foster care system, and we'll only be able to talk about the beginning part of that because of the nature of the book and what's revealed. I learned about the foster care system primarily through being a psychologist at college counseling centers and working with students who had sort of been bumped out of the foster care system. And their experiences could have been positive or not so positive. There's a full range of experiences with foster care families. But at that time, when they became 18 years old, they had nowhere to go. They were assumed to be adults, and the very fortunate ones got themselves into college. And I remember the very first time I met a student who was in that situation, Christmas rolled around, and she really had no place to go. And I remember just the completely stunned mind, body, spirit appearance of her when she realized everyone else had a place to go. She did not. So I've had experiences sort of on that end of the foster care system. I use the foster care system, however, as a way to demonstrate. Sometimes things are not as they appear. We can see things in one particular way, and in fact, our perceptions may be absolutely shaded by circumstances.
And this is something that also your protagonist, Rocky, is going through. She's seeing things in a certain way. Mm-hmm. They're not particularly that. You know, how we are blindsided. I think, what is it? Someone has said that, you know, humans are a meaning-making, you know, meaning-making is just hardwired into our brains. We have to interpret things, you know, we have to make meaning out of things, and even when we have very little information about them, we make those meanings. Is that something that you're talking about here in this novel, Picture This?
Yeah, I think for the most part, we're very quick to jump to conclusions, and I believe that we are hardwired to connect the dots as we see them. Even if we, you know, have very little information, we will quickly attribute a cause to a situation and connect the dots and make conclusions based on that, which can often be wrong.
Right, and therein lies the stuff of fiction.
Yes. Well, that is sort of the stuff of fiction, is that I think we are hardwired to want to have a full experience of a story, whether it's a play, a short story, a novel. Once we're into it, we want to be in there with the characters uncovering the truth.
Mm-hmm. There's another theme here of synesthesia. This is a mm-hmm. phenomenon that I'm going to ask you to explain. The character in this novel, this was very fully explained in Lost and Found, but it appears again in this book. Talk about synesthesia and why you seem to be so fascinated with it.
Synesthesia is a neurological condition where multiple senses fire at one time. For example, it is the kind of experience, if you can imagine, that you would taste an apple pie, and the sensation that you would have would be tactile velvet, or that if you heard a sound, you would have a taste in your mouth that was equated with that particular sound in your life. People who have synesthesia also have very lifelong associations, for example, with numbers. If there is that multiple firing with numbers, for example, the number 2 will always be green from the beginning of their life to the end of their life. The number 3 will always be black, for example. And the same thing with letters, days of the week, and so forth. So in some ways, Tess, the older woman in the book who has synesthesia, she is a little dog-like, if you will, because of the kind of sensory perception that she has. You know, Cooper the dog has a sense of smell, you know, that he can smell something, you know, 30 miles away in outside of Portland from the island. And Tess, when she had her synesthesia, had available to her a sensory way of being in the world that the other characters in the book did not. And in this particular book, the book begins with Tess recuperating from a surgery that saved her life. But for unknown reasons, it bumped out her synesthesia, and she is incredibly sad about this.
Was this a literary device, or can people lose and then regain synesthesia?
The loss of her synesthesia, this is why I love talking with you, Francesca. No one has asked me this. The loss of synesthesia is a literary device. I have not heard of anyone losing their synesthesia. I don't know if that is even possible. In this book, however, it happens.
That's great. A little more of that magical realism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Now, there's a love interest, which was also beginning to develop in your last book, Jacqueline Sheehan. Not the last one, in the first of this series, Lost and Found. A man who's a teacher. He's also an archery expert. I found it interesting that, on the one hand, Rocky is so credulous when it comes to Natalie, but so mistrustful when it comes to her boyfriend Hill.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think those things come together. She becomes more distrustful of Hill when Natalie comes on the scene. And Natalie begins to take more and more and more of Rocky's attention. Here is a way for Rocky to redeem herself, save herself, get a piece of her deceased husband back. And Hill represents everything that is present now, alive, healthy, strong, and vibrant. And so she's really torn between those two worlds. And she's a little distrustful of how to live in a world fully having loved her first husband and accepting a new love into her life at the same time. How can those two things exist? So she is struggling with that.
And I want to say that I felt that it took just a little bit of time in this book for you to really hit your stride in it. The voice. In the beginning, I felt that the voice was not quite matured, not quite clear. And then all of a sudden, it really kicked in. Now, this is just the way I experienced it. And it didn't take that long, but I noticed a change at a certain point where it did. And I wondered if that was something that you had consciously experienced in, or this is just something that I'm imagining.
Well, you're probably not imagining it if you were experiencing that. You're such a good reader. Things do begin to build and build and build in the book. And Rocky is a little bit sleepier in the beginning, especially with Natalie. she as at one point Melissa will say about Rocky that she's gone as stupid as a stone in regards to Natalie. So there is increasing evidence from the island, from all sources of people and events that would lead her to make other conclusions about Natalie.
Yeah. Did you talk a little bit about the process of writing this? Was there, what was it like to write a sequel? How was it as a process of becoming, you know, getting into your, did you get into your characters more? Did they develop more than they had in the beginning? Melissa, I certainly felt, did actually. She attained more dimensions in this, just as she matures. You said she matures in this. So I wonder if you could talk about the process of writing a sequel. How was that for you?
Well, I had two things going on with the whole notion of a sequel. When I was first writing Lost and Found, I thought to myself, I think there's more to this book than just one book. And sold it to HarperCollins. And when I presented that idea to them initially, they said, no, this is just a one-book contract. And then I quickly began writing another book, Now and Then, about an Irish-American family. And then HarperCollins came back and said, wait a minute. Now we see it. We do want a sequel for Lost and Found. So there was this gap period between the first book, which came out in 2007, and now. So I did have to reintroduce myself to the characters and do that balance of how much do I need to re-explain from the first book about these characters, or how much do we just want to drop into the lives of these characters as if we've just parachuted down into their skin and take off running. So that part of it was a constant sort of razor's edge for me.
Hmm. I think you handled it very well because, you know, it's been a couple of years since I'd read the first book, and this provided just enough detail for me to, you know, reorient myself, but really did move forward, move the story forward. What do you think moved HarperCollins to make the decision? Was it a literary one, or were they, you know, just so pleased with the success of Lost and Found that they wanted something else?
I think it was both. I mean, Lost and Found has sold over 400,000 books, and it's still pumping away. And also, I heard from so many readers, I love getting emails from readers, and they said, would you please? They said, we're not done with these characters. Would you please write another book? So there was that sort of momentum built around these characters. And I do think these characters have the sort of legs that a second book is very warranted with them. These are characters I am very fond of. I am particularly fond of Tess and her sort of seventh decade love life, and also with the teenage character Melissa, who's maturing. And it was a challenge for me to write about a young girl who was making the most negative choices possible. There was almost a kind of sort of psychologist part of me that wanted to reach in there and grab her out of that situation and fix her.
But you really couldn't.
I really couldn't, yeah.
Is there a third one in the series?
Well, I am working on a different book entirely. However, in the back of my mind, I have already thought of this sort of next part of Rocky's life and an incident that would sort of fall into their lives again on Peaks Island. But the next book that I'm writing is set in Guatemala, 1990 Guatemala, part of the Civil War, the horrible Civil War that happened in Guatemala. And the other part of it takes place in contemporary times with an immigrant from Guatemala. Completely different kind of book. Just
wow.
The thing that drives my publisher crazy.
Why does it drive them crazy?
I think it is easier for them to market a writer if you really stay in one sort sort of tight-knit genre. When I take a leap off and write about an Irish-American family and time travel and so forth, and then leap off to 1990 Guatemala in the Mayan Highlands, it's more of a struggle for them to market in that way.
What I find is interesting, though, is the theme really of trauma is a constant in these books.
It is, and loss is a constant. And I think it's that sort of thing that has always fascinated me, both in my own life. My father died when I was very young, age 9. And as a psychologist, when I work with people, it's that almost that mystery of if we are all going to experience traumas, which one of us will make it out of it, and you know, in a more well put together package to experience life, and who is going to be brought to their knees and not able to recover.
Well, it was a very enjoyable read, and I look forward to the next two, the next one in this series, and certainly the one that you're talking about with about Guatemala. Jacqueline Sheehan, thanks again for talking with us again on Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca.
Novelist Jacqueline Sheehan. Go to writersvoice.net to hear our 2007 interview with her about the first book in the Rocky and Cooper series, Lost and Found. We've reposted it as a web-only extra. Click on the link in this week's show post. Next up, we talk to Jean Ray about her delightful and insightful novel, Calling Invisible Women. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. If you're anywhere past 40, especially if you're a woman, you've probably experienced the sudden sense that you are invisible. Heads don't turn the way they used to when you were young and nubile. But what if you woke up one day and found that you really were invisible? As in, when you looked in the mirror, you saw nothing at all. That's what happened to Clover, the protagonist in Jean Ray's new novel, Calling Invisible Women. The funny thing is, her husband and son don't even notice she's invisible, although her best friend does. Eventually, Clover discovers she's not the only invisible woman in the world. She joins a support group for other women like her, and together they unravel the cause of their condition and learn some important lessons about themselves and how they want to relate to others. Jean Ray is the author of several best-selling novels. Calling Invisible Women is her fifth book. She's also the mother of writer Ann Padgett. Jean Ray, welcome to Writer's Voice. Now, you have written several novels before this wonderful novel, Calling Invisible Women. I read it in one delicious bite. This is your fifth. First, I want to ask you a little bit about your writing, because you tend to write about a subject that I think a lot of people don't write about. That is women of a, quote, certain age, unquote. You started writing when you were 60, is that right? Or publishing?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Writing.
Writing when you were 60. My goodness. Mm-hmm. And what was that about? Was that a long time coming, or was that just a fancy that took you over?
Well, both, really. I had always had a yearning to be a writer. And that's really all it was, is a yearning. My parents were Depression era people, and they wanted nothing more than for me to have an education which would provide a way for me to earn money for myself, that I would not ever be alone and without a job. So that's why I became a nurse, and I loved nursing. I have to say, I have no regrets about nursing. But years and years of nursing, and I never stopped loving it. But when I was 60, I had recently remarried, and I was very, very happy in my marriage. I was very, very happy in the current job that I had as a nurse, working for an internist here in Nashville. And it was before the baby boomers came marching into our lives. And so there was very little publicity for older people. And I used to see magazine covers that said beauty at 20, 30, and 40, or sex at 30, 40, and 50. And I, at 60, felt really rejected and felt as though I had dropped off the edge of some precipice. And it bothered me for a while in sort of a depressing way. And then I thought, I've got to do something about this. I've got to move on this. I've got to write something about this. And consequently, I wrote Julie and Romeo, which is about two aging lovers from very conflicted families who go ahead with their love. And I wanted the people in the novel to be savvy and funny and have good energy and be attractive and be sexual, so that perhaps someone who picked up my story could see that 60-year-olds can be this way. And as it happened, I had just read Romeo and Juliet and thought that would make a perfect plot, which it really did. It's something that I am very thankful to Shakespeare for. And the book went over. It sold very well. It got to the New York Times bestseller list. And that sort of started, well, not sort of, it started my career then as a writer. And I just went to work nursing at part-time and began writing more. And then in the last 5 years, I think I've been very happy and content. My husband and I moved into a new house. There have been a lot of changes in our lives. So I hadn't written anything until, again, I was deeply moved by this invisible woman thing. So that's my story as a writer. And as you probably know, my daughter is a writer and very well known and has the education of a writer. So she helped me with a lot of things like transitioning from chapter to chapter and a lot of technicalities that I wouldn't know as a nurse. I had the heart, but I didn't have the brain for it.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, and your daughter's Anne Paget. Since you've mentioned it, is there any kind of mother-daughter rivalry? It sounds like it's been more on the cooperative end of that.
It's a very cooperative relationship. We are deep friends. We're together almost every day. She lives two blocks from where I do. And we just see each other and help each other whenever we can. We don't talk so much about writing anymore. I mean, she writes her things, and then I usually read them in manuscript form and tell her what I think. And I write my things, and the same is true there. But we're not deeply involved in one another's decisions about plots and characters.
Well, I have to say, calling Invisible Women is a very tightly written, wonderfully plotted book. I just loved it. And with a great dry or wry humor to it as well. It starts when a 50-something Clover Hobart, your protagonist, looks in the mirror one day and she discovers that she's invisible. Do you happen to have the book there?
I do have a book here.
Okay, great. I wonder if you could turn to page 21 and just read for us this paragraph. Now, this is I believe this is the day after that she found that she was invisible in the mirror, and then she becomes visible again briefly.
Right.
And then becomes invisible again. So set us up. Tell us what's happening here and read this paragraph. It starts with, "And so I waited," and then just read that one paragraph. But first, tell us what's happening.
Okay. In the first chapter, everything kind of gets set up. As you said, Clover gets out of the shower and notes that she is indeed invisible. She's very frightened. She tries to call her husband at work. He's a pediatrician. He's very, very busy, and the nurses won't let her talk to him because he's so busy. And she is frustrated, and she goes in and wakes up her son, who has come home after college because he can't find a job. And he's just kind of sarcastic and pissed off because she woke him. And then she sees herself return to her flesh. She talks to her best friend and neighbor, Gilda. And although Gilda is very sympathetic, she doesn't see her at that time when she's invisible. So that's pretty much the first chapter. I think one comes to the reality that Clover is certainly in a frustrating situation. Although she loves her husband, she loves her children, she has grown used to being used by them, as most families do use the female matriarch in the family. So there are many ways in which Clover has become invisible to her family before she actually becomes invisible physiologically. So I suppose that sets it up.
It does.
All right. Then on page 21, this paragraph begins, "And so I waited, my invisible arms behind my invisible head." She's in bed, by the way. "Of course, I didn't know exactly when I'd vanished yesterday. Could it have been in the shower? Was it possible that I could have washed my hair without realizing I was gone? And then something else occurred to me, something darker and more unsettling. What if yesterday wasn't the first time? What if I had been flickering in and out for a while now, in my sleep or in the car or in the kitchen chopping vegetables? It had been years since I'd really kept an eye on myself. Could I be positive how long this had been going on?"
This has just really struck me because I can actually remember the day, the time, where I was when I realized that I was invisible. You know, it was in my 40s. You know, I think I was 40, had just turned 40.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed that I no longer got the attention that I used to get. So unwanted attention, it often was, but it just suddenly struck me that nobody ever looked at me anymore.
That's right. That's right. I know. I remember the same thing.
Yeah, it's quite a shock. So this is a metaphor, but it's also, you really play with this metaphor and make it real here. So your protagonist, Clover Hobart, finds other women in her same situation when she comes across a classified ad. Tell us about that.
She was a newspaper reporter full-time, and so she's interested in the paper, although I think that their little paper has sort of shrunk down to nothing, is quickly becoming invisible itself. And she likes to look through the want ads to see, A, if she could find a job for Nick, her son, and then B, to see if she could find something that she could be doing outside the home. And it's a habit with her. And she comes across an ad that she hasn't noticed before, which says, calling invisible women at the Sheraton Hotel at 10 o'clock the following day. And she really gets excited. And the next day then goes to the Sheraton. And through, I think, what is rather a group of funny situations, she meets all these other invisible women. She doesn't know how many are there. And they're all nude because when they wear their clothes are visible. So,
and they don't want to be discovered.
No, and they don't want to be discovered. And they don't rent this room that they meet in because nobody sees them anyway. So it's just a funny situation. They all carry Kleenex so that they won't sit on each other.
I love this. You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Jean Ray about her newest novel, Calling Invisible Women. You know, I could almost see how you were, your thought process, you know, how you were kind of discovering in this book all the implications of what it means to be invisible. You know, the kind of, I think most of us, we just stop thinking about it once we realize we are invisible to many people. But you actually discover through this book that there are some advantages, and these women, including Clover, really turn those advantages in their favor.
Yes, they do. I think they discover a great deal about themselves as well as discovering what the probable cause of their invisibility is. One of the things I really like about the book and am pleased with is that, and I think I said this before, but it's that we all do become metaphorically invisible, and Clover certainly had. And yet, when she became physically invisible, she learned so much about herself. She learned so much about her own self-importance and the importance of others. And she became a leader and consequently was very visible even in her invisibility.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think the thing I mean is I think we could all of us who are aging women and are no longer particularly interesting or attractive to others, whether it be men or women, I think we lose sight of the fact that we can become visible by thinking about other people and not thinking about ourselves, by extending kindnesses. Not in the way Clover did as sort of this household slave, but may I give you an example?
Oh, please do.
The other night I went out to dinner with a woman friend. She and I are good friends. And we were seated at a table in a restaurant, and we were facing each other. So she could see over my left shoulder that there was a table full of people, a large party. And suddenly, in the middle of dinner, she stood up and she walked over to that table. And I thought, oh, well, she must know someone there. And she had noticed that there was a woman at the table that was taking pictures of everybody. And she realized that the woman herself would not be in the pictures. So she just went over and offered to take pictures for her so that she could be in part of the pictures. And I thought that was a stunning thing to do. I mean, she kind of put herself out on a limb because the people could have been, I don't know, insulted or think that she was trying to steal her camera or whatever. And yet she did a real service for no reason other than that she noticed someone was in need.
It's like one of your characters, the mother, Clover's mother-in-law.
Yes.
She tells Clover at one point that the lesson may be not who sees you, but who you can learn to see.
Right. And exactly.
So how does, are you saying that invisibility does that because in a way it frees us from having to be involved with our appearance?
Oh, I think that's part of it, but I don't think that's the main part of it. I think maybe not our own attractiveness, but our own needs or fears or feeling that someone won't like us or be angry at us. We can extend our, we could extend ourselves more fully, I think, if we were invisible. We could allow ourselves to take chances that we don't take when we're visible.
Right. And Clover does this quite a bit. I mean, there's a number of ways. She does good works with others. She confronts a man in a parking lot who's abusing his girlfriend or his wife. But she also ends up doing some volunteer work in a school. And I love that. Talk a little bit about what she does there.
Well, number one, this wouldn't be Clover's favorite thing to do, but one of the women that she meets at the Invisible Woman's Group is a former teacher of her children, of Clover's children, and she likes her very much. And the former teacher really kind of encourages Clover to do some work at the school, and particularly on the school bus, where I think a lot of bullying and making fun of lesser students was taking place. And so Clover and this other teacher get on the bus, and of course the kids don't know it, and then they just go about the business of making room for the kid, for the poor child that nobody will make room for because they're too thin or too fat or something's wrong with them in the eyes of the other students. And they whisper things in the kids' ears to scare them, and they, in fact, I thought, a lot of fun doing this. I don't know. I think they were pretty exhausted when it was over, but What an adventure that would be.
Yeah, they whisper things in the ears of the bullies to kind of get them to withdraw a bit. It's just lovely. It was really, you really got a sense of the possibilities of what one could do there, you know. And I think one of the other characters says, invisible women are needed everywhere. You know, I would like to be in a hedge fund or on Wall Street.
Yes.
That's great. Now, so there's another plot line here in this book, and we're talking with Jean Ray about her wonderful novel. It's just a terrific read. It's called Calling Invisible Women. And that plot line is that there is a medical mystery at the heart of this physical invisibility. Now, I don't want to do any spoilers here, but tell us what you can about this aspect of the plot.
Well, when Clover meets with all these other invisible women, they explain to her that they have had the foresight to do a survey of what each of them has been, what medications each of them have been taking along the way. And they found that there were three medications that all of them had taken or were taking. And they're medications which would be very common to any woman past menopause. One was a bone rebuilder, Ostefos, I think I called it. One was a mood elevator, Singsol. And by the way, I love that name, Singsol. And one was an estrogen supplement. And they were all three made by the same pharmaceutical company. And they also had at some time at least one shot of Botox, but they weren't sure that that was influential in the whole invisibility thing. But they really became quite positive. Clover herself took those three medications, that those were the three meds that were rendering them invisible. And they do a lot more investigative work, and they go to the pharmaceutical company, and that's quite a big adventure.
Yeah, and I think we can leave that right there. Tell us, is there anything else that I haven't asked that you'd like to, a point you'd like to make about the book?
One thing that came up for me when I was giving a talk somewhere was several women in the room who had read the book said, you know, this really could be a self-help book. And although I really don't want to think of it as a self-help book, I think that my intentions were such that it could be something that women who were feeling invisible could read and perhaps find that they could do something about their invisibility, their metaphorical invisibility.
Yeah, in fact, that brings up a thought that I had, which is, you know, when you were talking before that being invisible can maybe leave you freer to do kindnesses or do good deeds for others, but also mm-hmm. this character in the book, as well as the other women, Clover Hobart, she really comes into her own in a very strong way. And I find it ironic, in a sense, that, you know, as I became more invisible, and I don't think there's necessarily a connection between the two, but as I became more invisible as I aged, also because I aged, I became more confident about who I was and what my kid, you know, I just gained an experience and wisdom.
That's right.
And I don't know if that there's a connection or it's just an irony that that's what happens.
I don't know either if there's a connection or if it's irony, but certainly that happened to me. I think I was most invisible chronically when I was in high school because I didn't have any idea who I was or where I was going. And I think as I became older, even though I went through certain periods where I wasn't getting that bling from being smashing pretty anymore. And I missed that. But then I found other ways to fill up that place, that hole in my life. And I think they were all very constructive ways. I mean, I started to write books, for one thing.
Well, this has just been a great talking with you, Jean Ray. Your latest book, the fifth novel that you've written, is Calling Invisible Women. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Francesca, thank you so much.
In addition to Calling Invisible Women, Jean Ray is the New York Times bestselling author of the novels Julie and Romeo, Julie and Romeo Get Lucky, Eat Cake, and Step Ball Change. You can read an excerpt from Calling Invisible Women by going to writersvoice.net. We have some time for a few poems from one of my favorite poets, Mary Oliver. Not far from where I lived once in western Massachusetts, there was a small lake where a beautiful big blue heron made its home. Mary Oliver's poem, Some Herons, reminded me of that bird, who I often observed with the greatest pleasure on my walks. Let's listen to her read that poem.
Some Herons. A blue preacher flew toward the swamp in slow motion. On the leafy banks, an old Chinese poet, hunched in the white gown of his wings, was waiting. The water was the kind of dark silk that has silver lines shot through it when it is touched by the wind or is splashed upward in a small, quick flower by the life beneath it. The preacher made his difficult landing, his skirts up around his knees. The poet's eyes flared, just as a poet's eyes are said to do when the poet is awakened from the forest of meditation. It was summer. It was only a few moments past the sun's rising, which meant that the whole long, sweet day lay before them. They greeted each other, rumpling their gowns for an instant and then smoothing them. They entered the water, and instantly two more herons, equally as beautiful, joined them and stood just beneath them in the black, polished water, where they fished all day.
Mary Oliver reading Some Herons from the CD At Blackwater Pond, Mary Oliver Reads Mary Oliver. My mother passed away on June 23rd. She told me before her death that she wanted her ashes scattered on her favorite beach, a small, peaceful promontory on Long Island's East End. So when I heard Mary Oliver read her poem, Bone, it felt right to include it on today's show.
Bone. Understand, I am always trying to figure out what the soul is and where hidden and what shape. And so last week, when I found on the beach the ear bone of a pilot whale that may have died hundreds of years ago, I thought maybe I was close to discovering something. For the ear bone is the portion that lasts longest in any of us, man or whale, shaped like a squat spoon with a pink scoop where once, in the lively swimmer's head, it joined its two sisters in the house of hearing. It was only 2 inches long, and I thought, the soul might be like this, so hard, so necessary, yet almost nothing. Beside me the gray sea was opening and shutting its wave doors, unfolding over and over, its time-ridiculing roar. I looked, but I couldn't see anything through its dark-knit glare. Yet don't we all know the golden sand is there at the bottom, though our eyes have never seen it, nor can our hands ever catch it, lest we would sift it down into fractions and facts, certainties. And what the soul is, also, I believe I will never quite know. Though I play at the edges of knowing, truly I know our part is not knowing, but looking and touching and loving, which is the way I walked on, softly, through the pale pink morning light.
Mary Oliver reading her poem, Bone. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon, at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. Drew Adamek is Writer's Voice Associate Producer. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.